This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Many people are spending quarantine exploring their kitchens. For people with more time on their hands now, it's a creative outlet that can yield, if not delicious results, at least lessons for next time. What have you been experimenting with in the kitchen? Do you feel like this strange time has made you a better cook? This hour, we invite you to share what you've done and the lessons you've learned along the way. And we want to know what's left in your fridge or your pantry, and maybe our panel can help you out with what to do with it. That panel is Abby Maris. She is the chef at the Indianapolis restaurant Bluebeard. Abby, welcome.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
The other chef at the table is Neil Brown, president and CEO of Neil Brown Hospitality Group, which has operated several restaurants in the Indianapolis area. Neil Brown, welcome.
Hi, Matt.
By the way, both of these chefs have multiple nominations for the prestigious James Beard Award under their belts. They're the real deal, and we're so glad to have them with us today. And because bread making has been such a popular quarantine activity, on the baking side, we have one of the best, baker and managing partner of Amelia's in Indianapolis, Charlie McIntosh. Hi, Charlie.
Hello.
And again, today's show will be so much better if we hear from you. What have you attempted in the kitchen in the last couple months? Has the pandemic made you a better cook? What have you learned? Have you found a new creative outlet in cooking for yourself? Has it given you a new appreciation for what the pros can do? Or, if you like, just list off a few random items in the pantry or fridge and maybe we can help. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail. Call us at 866-476-3881. Be sure to include your name and where you're calling from, and we will do our absolute best to get it in front of our panel today. Again, that's 866-476-3881. Neil Brown, you've been doing some great Facebook Lives from your home kitchen, and your most recent one really hit on what we're trying to do today with this show. You talked about what you called creativity through scarcity. What did you mean by that?
So creativity through scarcity is something that I actually preach in a lot of my kitchens to the young chefs, and that is to define the parameters of your cooking. And last night I used the example of Pizzology. Pizzology, our food was always sort of created through the lens of either being hyper-Italian or very local. And those were the sort of parameters that we would use to define how we could create. And what I find is that by putting limitations on what we're allowing ourselves to do, it actually gives us freedom because we want to constantly try to break out of that box, which I encourage. Define the boundaries and then push them to the extent that you can.
But it's important to define the boundaries so that you can figure out where you live, right? Because when you do that, it kind of it paints the lines so that you can then push the lines, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. So last night, sort of how I demonstrated this sort of this principle is, I knew I was going to make pasta. What I didn't want to do is make some sort of like mishmash, you know, some like, I don't know, Southwest chicken style pasta, right? So I was like, okay, so I'm going to make pasta and I want to define that pasta as something that can be very Italian. And so I had pasta, I had some tomatoes, I had some capers, some lemon, some red wine, and some celery and a little bit of pepperoni. And it turned out great.
Abby, have you been clearing a lot of pasta out of the pantry?
Oh, that's for sure. I think I was lucky enough to go to Italy back in maybe November or so. And I stuck that, not knowing this was all going to happen, I stuck that on a lot of dried pasta. So I've been lucky in a way to be able to start cooking from home more often. So, yeah, a lot of bucatini.
I've got a lot of pasta in my pantry as well. Now, before we get to more cooking advice, I've got to talk to Charlie because people have been baking like never before, especially bread. Have you been helping people out with bread?
Yeah, we've been answering a lot of questions through social media and email, and we've actually been selling a ton of like flour and sugar and yeast and butter through our online store.
Is that something that Amelia's did before, or were you just selling the actual finished products before?
No, we were only selling the finished product before, but now we're almost like a little corner store grocery bodega thing. We've also been giving out a lot of sourdough starter for free, because all the bread and most of the pastry that we make is all leavened with sourdough starter.
And sourdough is what I see popping up an awful lot on the breads that people are trying. And I admittedly, I have never in my life baked bread, so you might have to bring me along like the noob that I am. What is so challenging about sourdough to a beginner?
Well, it's mostly because it's not what people are used to. But once you mess around with it for a little bit, I feel like it's really quite easy. It's just you're used to the instant, you know, the grocery store yeast, which is quicker and more predictable.
And so what then, I guess, what makes sourdough, I suppose? Again, total noob here.
So sourdough starter is essentially you're creating a hospitable environment for beneficial yeast and bacteria to thrive. And you have to feed it every day to keep it at a state where you can bake with it. But so you're just creating that positive environment for the yeast and bacteria to thrive. And then that is what will in turn create the carbon dioxide to leaven your bread.
So if you're looking for tips on baking bread, Charlie McIntosh is on hand to help us out with that. Now, one of his coworkers, of course, with us, she is the 5-time James Beard Award nominated chef of Bluebeard. Abby, we may talk later about the state of restaurants and the status of restaurants represented today, which is an important thing to get across to people. And I'm sure that we have plenty to talk about on that subject if we come to it today. But right now we're going to concentrate on professional advice in the kitchen. And you and the restaurant you work for, Bluebeard, are known for vibrant and unique ingredient combinations. We heard Neil Brown a minute ago talk about creativity through scarcity, this idea that being limited on ingredients can actually be freeing. What kinds of dishes have you come up with that have fit this principle?
Well, are you talking about at the restaurant or in my personal life, in my personal kitchen?
How about in your personal kitchen? Because that's where we're all working these days.
So, again, going back to pasta, it's so easy to source, you know, some linguine, some dry linguine. So one dish that I love to make is everyone should always have a tub of crunchy peanut butter in their pantry, as well as the pasta. And then if you have just some simple vegetables like carrot and maybe some broccoli, even a little onion, salt potatoes together, and then add a big scoop of crunchy peanut butter, about a half cup of soy sauce, but a half cup of water or vegetable stock if you have it, and then simmer that together and throw in some cooked linguine. Then you have yourself a style of like a Thai noodle. So, and that's super easy to make at home, and people love it.
Well, a lot of that seems a little non-intuitive to a novice like me. I mean, obviously, peanuts are very prominent in Thai dishes, but it's never something that I would want to attempt myself. I guess that's what I think we should try to get at is this fear of the kitchen that so many people have. How often do you hear that from people, that they're just afraid of it?
Oh, I hear that very often. But the thing is, the more you get involved in your own kitchen and knowing the way around your cooking equipment, that'll only make you feel more comfortable. So you just kind of have to indulge yourself and spend some time and not be afraid. I mean, otherwise, I mean, it's never going to happen. So.
Well, and not being afraid to mess something up either, because chances are if you're working with food, you're going to end up with something that is at the very least edible. Whether it's tasty or not is, I guess, irrelevant. You have something that you can eat. We have a question from Ambika. Oh, my goodness. My apologies. On Facebook. And she says, I want to try the keto diet again, but I'm allergic to almonds. How do I work with coconut flour? I tried blueberry muffins and they had a weird aftertaste. Does anybody want to take that one?
I think Charlie should.
coconut flour, Charlie?
Yeah, well, coconut flour can have a grainy quality to it. And I think if you're going to bake with it, you can never use like all of the flour as coconut flour. That's the main thing to remember in my experience when baking with gluten-free stuff is that if it's a gluten-free flour, you just can't treat it like it's a normal flour because it's just not going to react in the same way. Well, I'm definitely not an expert in gluten-free baking. I have done a little bit here and there, but almond meal is pretty heavily used in gluten-free baking. So being allergic to almonds would make it a little more difficult.
Indeed. Neil Brown, go ahead.
Gluten-free oats are a good replacement, I find, for wheat flour, but you still have to have a binder of some kind. So quick breads are probably your better bet. If you're looking for a crusty sourdough that's gluten-free, if you find it, just let me know because I've never seen one.
That's the real trick, isn't it? I mean, when you're talking gluten-free, there are a few breads that you can include in the conversation, but it really, really limits things. Charlie, you said your experience is limited in gluten-free breads, but I guess what would be a simple thing people could do if they want to try it and stay gluten-free?
Well, I think a banana bread is a good place to start. Because the banana itself combined with a little egg kind of creates a binder, which can accommodate a lot of different types of flour. So you could use gluten-free flours and the loaf is still going to hold together well because the gluten is kind of the main thing that gives bread its structure and texture. So you're going to have a binder of some kind.
Makes things tricky. We're talking about cooking under quarantine, getting creative with what's left in the kitchen, and also offering some basic tips for adventurous home cooks. We have Indianapolis chefs Neil Brown and Abby Maris, as well as Charlie McIntosh from Amelia's with us. Send us your ingredient lists to Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can just leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back with our panel in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're joined by three Indiana food experts, two chefs and a baker to be exact, and we are taking your questions on quarantine cooking. How have you experimented in the kitchen? How did it go? Need some expert advice? Good news, we're live this hour. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a voicemail including your first name and where you're calling from to 866-476-3881. We have Chef Abby Maris from Bluebeard, Chef Neil Brown from Neil Brown Hospitality Group, and Charlie McIntosh from Amelia's Bread. And we do have a voicemail to kick off this segment. This is from Karen with a lesson that she's learned. Let's listen.
My name's Karen. I'm calling from Northeast Indianapolis. And what I've learned during quarantine cooking is lemongrass does not mix well with oregano. Thanks for what you do. Bye-bye.
Lemongrass doesn't go well with oregano. Neil Brown, you want to take that one?
Yeah, sure. So a nice rule of thumb is to consider ingredients from the same regions. And oregano and lemongrass are decidedly not from the same region. When you're looking at a certain ingredient, consider where it's from and try to stick to that region with that ingredient. And especially if you're kind of just starting out in the kitchen, it's a nice way to you're eliminating some risk by doing that. So, you think about oregano, and that's sort of a Mediterranean herb. You can get into South America, North America. Lemongrass is decidedly Asian. Those probably aren't good combinations.
It's okay to be adventurous, but sometimes it doesn't work out. And Neil, I want to throw another Twitter conundrum to you. We had a listener send us this list of ingredients. Let's see what you can do with it. Abby, I'd like to hear your ideas, too. Meg had this in her pantry. Kalamata olives, feta cheese, tomatoes. So already we have kind of a theme. This is a Mediterranean dish. Plus farro and tofu. This really doesn't sound too bad. Neil Brown, what can we do here?
No, this is super easy. You should cook the farro in some stock if you have it, some vegetable stock. If not, just use water. Make sure you season it. And you've got a really nice salad. You could even, if the tofu is firm tofu, you could even grill that or perhaps brown it. And you've got really a really nice salad. That sounds like a great lunch to me.
Abby, anything to add?
Well, I agree with that. Like a cold salad, just even chopping a tofu up, or you can even puree the tofu and make like a vinaigrette out of the tofu as well. So you can puree the tofu and maybe even a little bit of that olive juice from the olive bottle, and then toss it into the farro salad as well. And that'll kind of give it like a nice creamy texture and bind the salad all together. And it sounds great either hot or cold. So.
Oh, I love this. All right, we have another listener voicemail. They're rolling in. This one is from Robin. Let's listen to that now.
Hi, my name is Robin. I'm calling from Plainfield. And since the COVID-19 stay at home, I've decided to make chili. And I've made so many different recipes of chili, some good, some not so good. So that's what I'm doing. And I would welcome any new recipes for chili. Thanks. Bye.
Neil Brown, chili is my go-to as well, admittedly, but I keep things really, really simple. What's a way that we can kind of break from the norm, I guess?
Well, surprisingly, we're going to go back to peanut butter. A little bit of peanut butter in chili is actually phenomenal, and that sort of stems from kind of a traditional mole out of the Oaxaca region from Mexico. And I also almost always add a little bit of chocolate for some depth of flavor to chili. I make a lot of chili, and I almost always put a little bit of peanut butter and a little bit of chocolate in it.
Mm. We have a question from Lorraine on Facebook who asks, what can I do with leftover Jared Chipotle peppers? Abby? I don't even know if...
I'm so glad this is for Abby.
Jarred chipotle peppers. Jarred chipotle peppers. I said Jared. See, this is how much of a noob I am.
Okay, well, I'm much better now. Because I was confused. Well, I love chipotle peppers. So, again, I mean, going back to creating those and putting them into, like, a chili would be great to enhance the flavor in a chili. You can make a chipotle vinaigrette with lemon juice or lime juice and chipotle and a little sesame oil and a little bit of blended oil. You can even make a spread with some, grab some cheddar cheese, process that together with some chipotles, and you can have a nice spread for some bruschetta or a really cool grilled cheese that's spicy. There's a lot of interesting. Oh, you can make Velveeta cheese dip, you know, put some pureed chopped up chipotles in there.
That sounds delicious. A little Velveeta dip, nice.
Anywhere we can really use spice, right?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
I think anywhere where you would normally use chilies, you could add a little chipotle.
Yeah.
Yeah, good call. Holly on Twitter sent us this comment. My girlfriend and I began eating vegan about 4 months ago, and she has a gluten allergy, so we've used this time of physical distancing to try so many amazing things, lots of quinoa bowls, but we've also been perfecting a lot of Thai, Venezuelan, and Mediterranean food. So Holly is getting adventurous in the kitchen. Charlie, a lot of restaurants have been closed, of course, but I understand that you've kept pretty busy. What have you been doing at Amelia's Bakery?
Well, I sort of mentioned it earlier, but we've converted it into essentially a grocery store where you can order everything online and we'll pack it up for you. And you just swing by the side of the building and we drop it off in your car for no contact pickup.
And so many people are baking bread. You know, if you're a beginner like me, you've never baked bread before and you got a little time on your hands, what's an easy one to start with?
Well, bread can be incredibly simple. I think the first step, though, is to just be okay with making bad bread to begin with. But really just flour, water, salt, and then some leavening, which we're always using sourdough starter. I think everyone should give it a shot because it's really easy to work with, just as easy as yeast once you start.
Abby Maris, I'll tell you what's in my pantry, and it ain't much. First of all, I'm, as I said earlier, swimming in pasta, especially spaghetti of all kinds. So I've got to go through some spaghetti. I also have some canned mushrooms and black olives, two jars of Prego, way too much Prego. And it's the low sugar kind. Yeah. Various cooking oils, some nice Parmesan Reggiano in the fridge, along with some shredded mozzarella and a lot of frozen broccoli. Do I just make a hodgepodge spaghetti dish? What do I do?
Well, you could obviously do that.
Would it be any good, though?
That depends on what your standard of good is, I suppose. Well, okay, I will say that with your pantry, I mean, a baked spaghetti is, like, super simple to make with all those items, and you can throw the mushrooms in there, put a lot of cheese, and then put that into a pan, and then, yeah, you just do mushrooms, cheese and then pasta and then bake it and then top it with some more cheese. I mean, that's like a simple way to go about it. And then maybe garnish it with some of the olive. You said olives, right?
Oh yeah. I got a can of olives.
Yeah. And then yeah, garnish it with some olives and some more
that
cheese.
Sounds delicious. Whenever I think spaghetti, I never think to bake it. I just put it in the, you know, I just, I just boil it and serve it up that way. But to bake it would be something that would be different in my house. We are talking about quarantine cooking today, and we are with Chef Abby Maris from Bluebeard. We are with Neil Brown from Neil Brown Hospitality, and we are also with Charlie McIntosh from Amelia's Bakery. And we are taking your questions and comments on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. We're also taking voicemails at 866-476-3881. Neil Brown, on your latest Facebook Live, you used up a lot of different fresh ingredients that were already in your kitchen. And one that caught my attention was celery. And when you picked it up, you said you were using it because you didn't have any onions. Why would celery be a substitute for onions?
Yeah, there are a lot of people actually question that. So I wasn't necessarily saying that it would be a good replacement for onion, but what I was really looking for was some texture. The pasta dish really needed some level of texture, because all I had in there were capers, pepperoni, tomato, red wine, olive oil, a little bit of butter. So those are all pretty homogeneous textures, which is to say not a lot of interest, frankly. So anything that you can bring to brighten something up when you're talking about rich or briny flavors is a good thing. So the celery, I didn't have any onion, by the way, that is correct. And I also didn't have any garlic. So I used the celery to bring a little bit of texture to the dish. And I used the celery to also bring a little bit of brightness to the dish that's a little different than the capers. So as I explained in the video, fennel would be used prominently in Italian cuisine. And celery and fennel, if you use the right part of celery, celery and fennel have very similar characteristics from a flavor standpoint. So it's not a huge stretch to use celery. I mean, we would use celery in a bolognese anyway, but it's not a huge stretch to replace onion / fennel for a little bit of celery.
Well, and you also use the leaves, and I love celery. I love the flavor, but I've never used the leaves. I don't know why. I've never even considered them. What can we do with those leaves? Should we use them every time?
Yeah, you should, for sure. They're you treat them almost like an herb, honestly. And celery basically has three parts. It has the leaves, it has the outside stalks, and it has the inside stalks. The inside stalks are very tender, very sweet. You can use those in salads, use those in the pasta dish. And the outside stems typically are great for stocks or anything that you want to use to develop sort of long cooked flavors. Put those in braises, or as a bed for roasting a piece of meat or mushrooms or something like that. So the outside stems need a long cooking time. The inside stems are tender and sweet and can be used fresh, and the leaves can be used as an herb.
Mm, that sounds delicious. We have another listener voicemail. This one is from John. Let's listen.
Hi, this is John Sandu from the South Side. Love Amelia's and Bluebeard. When are you guys going to do an all-you-can-eat buffet? Thank you. Have a good one.
Abby, is that in the cards at all?
I don't see that anywhere. Maybe it's another restaurant concept down the road.
It just doesn't seem like an all-you-can-eat buffet kind of place, but I would go.
Yeah,
it does sound exciting.
Yeah.
We have another listener voicemail from Mary who has a question about a cooking ingredient you might not think about. Let's listen.
Hi, my name is Mary, and I am calling from Northwest Indianapolis. And I didn't know if you could ask Abby about making a dish with popcorn. I watched her and was fascinated at a show where she demonstrated her excellent culinary skills, and she used popcorn as the base for, I think it was a corn cheddar soup. So that might be an ingredient a lot of people have on hand, and she might be able to recall that event when she was on stage with some other chefs. Thank you.
Abby, do you pop the popcorn first?
Yes, I remember. Well, this was a couple years ago. It was a very fun event. So the secret ingredient. So it was popcorn. So I had popcorn. I think it was popcorn that was, I think it was caramel popcorn actually. And I just steeped that popcorn in some water, or you can use chicken stock, and then just make like a popcorn broth. And in turn, I made a corn chowder with that. So then I used the popcorn stock to make the base for the corn chowder by sauteing the corn kernels, not the popping popcorn, but corn kernels, and then onion and garlic, and then added some cream and some cheese to it.
Is popcorn something that you can turn to more often than you think?
Well, I suppose so. I mean, I do like the idea of like breaking it down into like to flavor broths, or even like a base for chili would be good. Then you can puree that. I'm really big into pureeing, apparently. Yeah, as long as you strain the popcorn liquid like through like a fine mesh strainer, that way you'll get any of those harder shelled kernels out of there, so it doesn't cause any kind of weird texture.
Charlie, I've been seeing a lot of no knead recipes. Again, total bread novice here. What quality do we get from not kneading the bread?
Well, you get less oxidation by not kneading it in the dough, which just really contributes to more flavor in the final product. And it's easier, so it's really the better way to go.
Yeah, because you're just literally doing not as much work. Do you have a simple, quick, no-knead recipe maybe off the top of your head, maybe just a few ideas?
Yeah, so if you just want to do like a little basic bread. You could even use instant yeast with it or sourdough. I would do like one part flour to 0.75 parts water. I'm sorry, I'm used to doing everything by weight in the metric system. I'm trying to convert this in my head. But yeah, essentially you want the flour to be the main part of it, the water to be about 70% of the weight of the flour. And then if you're going to use yeast, just have it be 2% of the weight of flour, which would be pretty small for, like, say you're doing a 2-pound loaf, which would fit into a standard home pan pretty easily. And then you want to go at 2% salt level too. And so it's just like the water, the flour, the salt, and the yeast. And then you just mix it by hand together, and you want to wait about a half an hour between every fold. And when you fold it, you're just kind of stretching it upwards and then like laying it over itself. And then you do that from every direction.
There you go. Simple and easy. No need bread. Neil, what about, we've got about a minute left. What about cooking oils? What's what? I mean, I've got multi-purpose vegetable oil. I've got a grapeseed oil and olive oil, Pam spray. Is oil a realm for creativity as well?
Oil is really a vehicle for cooking, and really transferring heat. So, you know, I mean, when you're talking about something like a salad dressing, olive oils, and olive oil blends tend to be better for carrying flavor, because they actually have a little bit of flavor. Things like grapeseed oil are phenomenal for sauteing, or, searing meat or vegetables, because it's a very, that oil has a really high smoke point. In fact, I think it has the highest smoke point, of really any of those oils. So, you know, using fruity oils for dressings and things that you want to really impart some flavor into, also like pasta sauces. I know we've talked a lot about pasta, but that works well. So
we'll have to leave it at that for now. Plenty more to cover. We'll get to more of your quarantine cooking questions and comments on Facebook and Twitter. Send them our way. I'm Matt Pelzer. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. Today we're joined by two Indianapolis area chefs in Abby Maris from Bluebeard and Neil Brown from Neil Brown Hospitality Group. And we have Charlie McIntosh from Amelia's Bread to answer your bread making questions. We're talking about quarantine cooking. What have you been doing in the kitchen while you've gotten all this time on your hands and spending all this time at home? And we will get to another tweet. This one's for Abby. And this one is from a guy named Tom, who says, my wife has begun the adventuresome task of making our own kefir or ricotta cheese or sour cream. The extra kefir goes into more smoothies than we can drink, but my toddler is happy to try. Abby, have you had any experience with simple cheese making like this before?
Yeah, I've made some mozzarella in my past, and then we do make our own like creme fraiche here at the restaurant and at home, and that's super easy to do. Or you can make like a clotted cream, which is fairly simple and easy to do at home. It's just a matter of pouring your cream and like letting it kind of like almost bake really slowly overnight in a very like low oven, and it can make like a clotted cream or an easy creme fraiche just using heavy whipping cream and buttermilk. So like just two ingredients, and then you get a really nice product, but it just takes a little patience.
Yeah. It seems like that might be a little bit of a technique that might be, well, I guess something that requires a little more time and patience, like you said. Now, Neil, I keep coming back to these Facebook Lives you've been doing because they're really good. They're really educational. You shared a tip that I've never heard before, but again, total noob. Whenever you add something to a pan, what do you do?
Season it.
Yeah.
yeah. So think of it as, so this is how chefs layer flavor. Whenever you add something to a pan, you need to season it. And when chefs use the word season, we almost always mean salt, and sometimes mean salt and pepper. So just think about it in terms of that you're diluting a flavor of something when you're adding anything to it. And the way to not dilute that dish's flavor is to add a little pinch of salt each time you add something to it. So yeah, that's the trick. Season as you go.
And that's all it takes is just a little pinch of salt. And if you're doing pepper, a little pepper as well. Don't have to go crazy.
Yeah. So, you know, you start your, let's say you're sauteing something, you start your onions or your, whatever allium you're using, onions, garlic, et cetera. You want to season that. And then, if you're going to be adding something else to that, you'll want to season that too. Now, a lot of times when you're sauteing something, a little bit of meat will come into play. If that's something that is like a sausage, or in this case, yesterday it was pepperoni, you'll notice that I didn't season the pepperoni because pepperoni already has a lot of salt inherently in it. So by adding the pepperoni, I'm adding a salt element anyway. And by adding the capers, I was also adding a salt element. So I didn't season those two, but everything else gets seasoned as you go.
We have a message on Facebook from Lisa. This will be for Charlie. Lisa says, I haven't made bread successfully in years because I think I murder yeast. I make sure that the date hasn't expired, and yet it doesn't rise. Please advise. Lisa, what, or sorry, Charlie, what is Lisa doing wrong?
Well, I mean, it could just be the yeast. If she's got the liquid, like, far too hot, it could actually kill the yeast.
And so that's probably just what's happening.
That would be my guess, because otherwise, you know, you can... I mean, it's fairly durable except to temperature, and then the expiration date would be the other obvious thing. But if the date is right, you don't really need, I mean, room temp water is perfectly fine for using yeast. You don't actually have to even add sugar or honey or even have warm water. It just room temp, it will work perfectly fine. You just want to give it some time.
And Charlie, a lot of the bread recipes that I've seen call for some specialized equipment. What if I don't have something like a stand mixer?
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you're doing like the no-knead method, those are essentially designed to just do in a bowl or a little tub or, I mean, any sort of container. You don't have to have a mixer. And the more highly you hydrate the loaf, the easier it will be to do with your hands, like the folds and... mixing together. You know, if it's a dry dough, it'll be easier if you have a mixer. So just add a little more liquid. And then, you know, like they were talking about salt earlier, you want to be sure to add a little more salt too, or it's going to be a less flavorful bread.
Abby, for people stretching their grocery store trips, what I guess are some basic tips for making produce last?
Last log, you need to use it.
Just use it. Don't try to keep it.
I mean, I would definitely consider like what you're purchasing and like what the time frame is that you're going to be using it. So, I mean, I always make sure to have onions and garlic on hand because those are a little more shelf stable than other produce options. Carrots are always great to have on hand. Cucumbers to spruce up any kind of like bag salad if you choose to purchase bag salad. If you decide to purchase like iceberg lettuce, a trick that I've learned a while back when I was younger was that when you take it out of the plastic bag, just to cover that with dry paper towels and then store that in like a lower, not in the drawer necessarily, but just like right there at the bottom, that continues to last a little bit longer. If you want to spruce any kind of green up that seems to be getting a little bit wilty, you can always soak that in some ice water for a little bit to kind of bring it back to life. And it also works for cucumbers or anything that's has a lot of chlorophyll built into it. What else? I think apples are always a good staple to have on hand.
It's asparagus season right now.
Yeah, and if you do purchase asparagus from the store, when you store that, it's a good thing to do. Just set it into a container that you can stand the asparagus up and just have like a little bit of water at the bottom of the container. So that would just kind of keep it alive a little bit longer if you don't plan on using it immediately.
Yeah, maybe trim a quarter inch off the bottom of the asparagus too.
Yep.
There you go. Neil, we got this tweet from BF who says, I have finally perfected the white bread and Kraft American singles grilled cheese. That's all they wrote. But that, I guess, gets me thinking, what are some safe ways to make those simple comfort foods like grilled cheese a little more interesting?
Put cheese on the outside of it. one of my favorite things in the world is a grilled cheese sandwich where you take in a nonstick pan, you take a little bit of whether it's cheddar. I would not probably do this with American cheese. Put your American cheese on the inside because there's a place for that. But take cheese and grate it into a nonstick pan. Put your bread right on top of it and grill cheese on the outside of the bread with cheese on the inside. And you just treat it like a grilled cheese sandwich, but it's got melted cheese on the outside, and it's probably one of the best things you're ever going to have.
Neil, I talked to Abby a little bit about this earlier, but I want to get your perspective. I mean, cooking is scary to a lot of people. I mean, I think too many people. I mean, there are just some fears that makes sense. Things like sanitation or setting the room on fire. I mean, those have real consequences. But a lot of these fears that people have about cooking are just the fear of making something bad or the fear that comes with thinking you don't know what you're doing. So why do it? What would you say to those people who want to overcome those kinds of fears?
Well, I think their fear is out of care for others, right? I think they're worried that they're going to, I don't think they're worried that they're going to make something taste bad. I think they're worried that they're going to disappoint someone else, right? I think engaging your family in the kitchen is probably the best way to help alleviate those fears. Get others involved so that if you fail, you fail together, and there's not as much pressure. Because the reality of it is it's very unlikely that you're going to make anything that's just terrible. I mean, unless you're just an abysmal cook, and certainly there are people out there that don't know anything about cooking. But the reality is you're probably not going to make anything terrible. If you just use a few simple rules and use some recipes as guidelines to start to learn how to cook, the likelihood of you failing and like ruining someone's day is probably pretty minimal.
We are on with chefs Neil Brown and Abby Maris from Indianapolis, as well as Charlie McIntosh from Amelia's Bakery, and we are talking about quarantine cooking. But I want to pivot a little bit in our last few minutes. Neil, I kind of wanted to stay away from this part of the conversation because I didn't want to kill the vibe, at least until now. But we've got to address this as long as we have prominent people from the restaurant industry joining us. How have you been? Honestly, how are you feeling about things?
Every day is different. You know, it's obviously the biggest professional challenge, I think, of all of our careers. And I went through 2008 through the recession. So yeah, it's pretty challenging. I think, you know, we're trying to decide if there is a future for the kinds of restaurants that we want to offer, and what, if we decided to stay open, what those restaurants might look like going forward. You know, every day it seems like there's new information coming. And so it's hard to sort of keep abreast of all that. But the one thing is there's so many of us that are going through it. And there are so many good, productive conversations happening that I think we're at least we all feel like we really are kind of in it together. So that's I take comfort in that.
Abby, how have you been feeling? You've been keeping busy, but this isn't exactly the kind of work you're used to. And I'm sure you'd like to get back to it.
Yeah, I mean, I feel very similar to what how Neil feels about everything, I think. Yeah, it's definitely been challenging. I mean, we're learning a lot every day about like even what we're capable of doing here in our own business. You know, we have been lucky that we have a grocery store, and we're able to continue to produce food for the community. But yeah, it is, you know, everyone is a little nervous, but, like Neil was saying, there are a lot of really interesting things coming out of this and how people can learn from each other, and we can all grow and hopefully hope for the best. So,
Charlie, Amelia's Bread has a lot of restaurants in its clientele. How much of an impact has this had on the bakery? How much would you say you've scaled back?
Well, at least on the wholesale side, you know, we supplied a lot of different restaurants and markets around the city, and the wholesale has dropped off significantly. But there are anyone who's been able to kind of convert and has, you know, like a grocery store type vibe to them now, like Goose the Market, they're ordering, you know, as much bread as they ever have. It's been a challenge for sure, but we're doing so much more now that it really hasn't felt any less busy for us. It's just different.
Neil, it seems like every week we hear about a couple more prominent restaurants closing. There are resources out there to prevent this, but I've heard that things like the PPP loans are really hard for restaurants to take. Why is that?
Yeah, well, the terms of the forgivable portion of the loans aren't really sufficient, frankly. There's a time limit in which you have to bring your staff back to 75% and 100% of your original sort of staffing levels. And that time limit is rapidly approaching. In fact, I think it's this month. So there are restaurants that may have just received their PPP loans, as maybe even this week. And it may be a case where they're expected to, by next week, have their staffing levels back to 100% in order to have those loans convert into grants. And that's just not realistic when you're talking about 25% occupancy in your restaurants. If you only have 25% occupancy, you only need 25% of your original staff, right? So the terms of the loans really just weren't well thought through, unfortunately.
At least not for the restaurant industry. Have you been able to take any, or have you chosen to take any?
I chose not to. I think it's too much risk. I think that we would not be able to achieve the staffing levels that we would that were expected to pay those loans back. And I fear for a fall resurgence of COVID-19 too. So I really didn't want to take on any more debt and any more risk. So yeah, I chose not to take any PPP loans.
And Neil, some restaurants have been getting by with carryout, and that comes with its own set of challenges. It seems like from the conversations I've had with people that it's often not quite enough to keep things going. But you have been getting creative with some pop-up stuff. What's this one-trick pony thing I've seen?
Yeah, it's just I want to cook. I think like all of us, Charlie and Abby and all chefs, we're just, you know, we're like racehorses. We just want to cook. We want to get out and we want to cook. And so without a restaurant right now that's sort of operating, I really just wanted to get out and cook. So I've been doing pop-ups. It gets some of my friends. I've got some friends that, you know, are kind of tied up and they're stuck at home and they want to be cooking. And so it gives them an outlet to get out of their houses and cook. And make a little bit of money, of course, to keep the business afloat. But it's a blast. We focus on one dish at a time, and it's a lot of fun. You can check that out at One Trick Pony Indy on Instagram.
All right, and I've only got about a minute left here, less than a minute, and a lot of people pride themselves, Neil, on supporting local and eating local. Was the support there before the pandemic? Were enough people putting their money where their mouths are, so to speak?
Well, that's a really hard question because, you know, I think we live as chefs and independent restaurateurs. I think we live in a little bit of an echo chamber, but the numbers really don't pan out the way that sort of our echo chamber says they would. We need significantly more support from the community supporting local restaurants. The past 5 years have seen probably the greatest restaurant renaissance in Indianapolis, and the support hasn't increased with the amount of restaurants that have opened. And so we would need to see significantly more support from a local standpoint to be viable in the future.
Well, I want to thank all of you for your time. Neil Brown, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Chef Abby Maris, thank you.
Thank you.
Charlie McIntosh, we appreciate your time.
Thanks.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Adam Gross is our technical director. We're on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. This is All In.